Welcome. Good afternoon. In the name of the Portuguese Parliament, please feel welcome to the House of the Portuguese Democracy. And we have two commissions of the Parliament, the Healthcare Commission and the Foreign Business Commission. So we thought this would be a subject that could interest both parliamentary commissions. So we are planning to give you the floor for a 12-15 minute intervention. Then I will pass I will give the word to the deputies by parliamentary group and individual interventions too, and then we will give you again the floor to answer some questions, to comment some observations, and once again feel welcomed, and I give you the word. And I'm the president of the Healthcare Commission, and the deputy Sérgio Sousa Pinto is the president of the other Foreign Affairs Commission.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having us today. So I am Diane Stewart. I'm the deputy director of external relations and communications for the Global Fund. My apologies that my Portuguese is non-existent, so I have to speak English today. And I'm accompanied by two colleagues. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Good afternoon. My name is Jan Van Damme. I work in donor relations in the Globes, and I'm in charge of the relations with Portugal and also with the European Commission and with Belgium. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Okay, thank you.
Vlas Tigarakis, Program Coordinator for the Global Fund's Debt Swap Program.
So thank you very much for your time. I thought I would start with an explanation of the relationship, which is long and warm, with the Portuguese government and the Global Fund. We have been partners since the beginning of the Global Fund, and Portugal is a long-standing donor as well. We would like to share with you perhaps some of the results that we've achieved during our partnership, and then perhaps have a discussion around some of the work that the Global Fund does. So if that's amenable, I'll start right away perhaps with where we are right now in the relationship. Portugal is a very generous and long-standing donor to the Global Fund, $17.2 million to date. The current pledge level from the country, at its highest level, you were contributing around $8 million per replenishment to the Global Fund. The current pledge level is about €1.5 million. As well as a contribution most recently, which was a joint public and private contribution to the Global Fund's COVID response. So thank you so much for both of those contributions. Let me talk a little bit about our latest results report, and you can see what it is that we do. As a reminder, I'm sure many of you are very familiar with the Global Fund, but as a reminder, we have a significant footprint in investments in global health all over the world. We work in more than 120 countries, and we disperse every year. Last year was our biggest annual disbursement ever, $5.2 billion in 120 countries. So it's a significant contribution to global health, and it's a significant contribution to some of the poorest countries in the world. So right now, we have about $17.5 billion under investment. And in our latest results report, and we can share the results report in Portuguese with you now, we have saved 65 million lives since the start of the Global Fund. The Global Fund is very much focused on impact and data, and so we count our impact in lives saved. 65 million lives for a disbursement of 65 about $63 billion over the course of 22 years. The results report has detailed programmatic information per country, but I wanted to give you some sense, and it's on the first page of this results report. Perhaps you can circulate it. Just a taste for what we do in each of the diseases. So right now there are 25 million people all over the world, financed by the Global Fund, who are on antiretroviral therapy for HIV. As you know, that is a life-saving treatment. So we are very pleased that we are able to continually increase the number of people on antiretroviral therapy. We also treated 7.1 million people for tuberculosis during 2023. And for malaria, just one of the measures is that we treated 44.6 million children, that's children under five, with seasonal malaria chemo prevention. So that is a drug that actually protects children for the whole malaria season from getting malaria. And as you know, malaria is one of the biggest killers still in sub-Saharan Africa for children under five. We also have a significant impact on health systems. And for the first time in our new results report, you will see on the back data that is designed to show how much space we have freed up in the health system. So when you treat communicable diseases, you protect the health system from being overwhelmed. 1.66 billion hospitalization days have been averted. So you can imagine how much capacity that creates in your health system to treat things other than communicable diseases. That investment has generated $85 billion in cost savings in a health system. Again, you can directly attribute that to other health activities, if that's the case. And we also did a calculation of the productivity gains of investing in these three biggest killers in the poorest countries in the world. And we believe we have productivity gains of about $400 billion during the course of the investments of the Global Fund. So you'll recall when the Global Fund was first created, it was, in fact, for economic reasons, because the economies in many of the poorest countries in the world were being destroyed by these diseases that kept workers at home. My own country, South Africa, HIV was ravaging exactly the working age population of the country, between 20 and 35. There are now 8 million people in South Africa on antiretroviral treatment who are alive today because of the early interventions from the Global Fund. We also have an impact on market shaping. We are one of the biggest procurers of health products anywhere in the world. We spend about $1 billion every year on medications and therapies for these three diseases and for the health systems that underlie them, diagnostics, other kinds of medical devices. And what we do with our market shaping is reduce the cost because we are able to provide such a large-scale procurement for these products. So over time, we've been able to reduce the cost of drugs or bed nets to affordable prices so that we can scale them up. And just last year, we further achieved a reduction of 20% on antiretroviral therapy. So it used to be, when the Global Fund was first created, that a year's course of antiretrovirals would cost $10,000 for one person for 1 year. Now that price is $45 for one person for 1 year. So you can imagine the scale-up that you can achieve with those kinds of cost reductions. And we've been doing that with some of the new and innovative tools as well. You might be aware that there's quite a lot of antimicrobial resistance, especially in the diseases that we treat. So ACTs, the treatment for malaria, there is increasing resistance to those drugs. There's also increasing resistance to the drugs we have for tuberculosis. And so we have been trying to address that and the resistance to insecticides by introducing new and innovative tools and introducing them at scale. So I mentioned that Portugal is a long-standing donor to the Global Fund, also a long-standing member of the board, which is really important because you participate in our governance and guide the investments that we make. And the Global Fund really does align very closely with Portuguese interests. So far to date, we have disbursed $3.2 billion in Lusophone countries over the course of the last 20 years. That is a significant return on your investment of 17.2 million to the Global Fund. And in addition to countries during the COVID response, Lusophone countries during the COVID response, we dispersed an additional $240 million just for them to work on the COVID response. So to give you an example, perhaps from Mozambique in our latest results report, and all of the results per country are available on our website. So you can go and look at any of the countries you're interested in, and you'll get the full country data there. But for Mozambique, to date, we've dispersed a total of $2.3 billion over the course of the 20 years. About 1.35 billion of that is for HIV. HIV is a very heavy burden, as you know, in sub-Saharan Africa. And Mozambique's achievement in HIV is quite significant. They haven't quite reached the UNAIDS goals of 95, 95, 95, but they are almost there, certainly on identifying people who are HIV positive and putting those people onto treatment. I think they're around 87% for both of those. Just below 80%, around 77% for keeping people on treatment, which, as you know, is one of the more challenging things. But that's a remarkable achievement for the country. They've also achieved 90% elimination of mother-to-child transmission. So they're really nearly there at 100% achievement of no transmission to from mother to child. The other impressive result they've achieved in the last year is 100% testing for malaria cases. So any suspected malaria case is immediately tested and confirmed and then treated if it's tested positive. And as you know, diagnostics is a key part of ensuring children get treated quickly, and of course that reduces the risk of mortality. In Cabo Verde this year, we achieved malaria elimination. You probably heard about that. That was announced earlier this year. So that's very exciting, and we're actually facilitating a partnership between Cabo Verde and São Tomé and Príncipe to pass those lessons on, because São Tomé and Príncipe is very keen to achieve malaria elimination themselves. So that's just a little snapshot of some of the achievements in the Lusophone countries, but we will be updating our document on all of the latest results. We only just presented these results in New York 2 weeks ago. So we'll be updating the document on the results in all the Lusophone countries, which will probably be of interest to you, and we'll be able to get that to you shortly. When we looked at the results that we've achieved, which as we know are quite impressive, we're worried about a few things. So I'll just mention those, and then maybe we can have a dialogue about some of those challenges. Firstly, the colliding crises that we see in the countries where we work. I mentioned Mozambique. Mozambique's a good example of where these challenges come together. So climate change and extreme weather events and instability and violence. So you have the challenges that Mozambique has in the north with the insurgency and other challenges, displacing people moving south, and then you have things like Cyclone Freddy coming in, causing flooding in places where they're not used to having flooding. So in some cases, it was actually where we had moved warehouses because we thought they would be out of the flood zone, and then they actually flooded in places that weren't expecting to be flooded. So we're seeing that throughout many of the countries, that between extreme weather, there was just flooding in the Sahel countries 2 weeks ago. And we know the challenges, for example, in Sudan, which is a terrible conflict that's ongoing that nobody's talking about, which was also sparked in part by displacements due to drought and climate change. So We're looking at those challenges and seeing how can we best invest in more resilient health systems in the face of climate change. But also we are one of the few organizations that's able to work through the crisis between a sort of development mode, moving into a humanitarian mode, moving back into development mode, because we stay. So in countries like Niger, we are the only remaining partner once the French had withdrawn. In Afghanistan, when the US withdrew and many of the international partners had not yet figured out how they were going to work with the new Taliban government, the Global Fund was the only one supporting the health system for 2 months during that interregnum period. And then my last point would be around the investments that the Global Fund makes in the underlying health systems. So yes, we count our achievements in the achievements against HIV, TB, and malaria. It's impactful and it's life-saving. But we are investing in a more sustainable health system underneath that. We invest in the health workforce, primarily in community health workers and those frontline investments. We invest in the supply chain, making sure that there are warehouses, making sure that the supply chain deals with waste management, which is a huge issue around many of the environmental issues that countries are facing. And in particular, we've been investing since COVID in two big transformations, I would say, across the sub-Saharan Africa in particular. One is around diagnostics, surveillance, and lab systems, which is so important for pandemic preparedness. So building up capacities in countries and in the region for more sophisticated surveillance around pathogens. And the second big investment we did was in oxygen provision. So that was very much on the back of the COVID crisis, where many countries don't actually have proper oxygen production plants. They rely on canned oxygen. And so in a country like Kenya, for example, we've invested in a complete overhaul of the oxygen supply. We've built 22 PSA plants to produce oxygen, pipe into the hospital and so on, in 47 different locations. So that is really going to have a huge impact on the wider health system, maternal health, child health, neonatal health. So a wide range of investments that we've been doing in the health system. So let me leave it there. We very much look forward to a conversation around how we can improve our relations with Portugal. We're talking on a number of fronts that I'd be happy to explain. One would be around increasing Lusophone expertise and the availability of Portuguese-speaking experts in the countries where we work, because we really see a gap there. We have the money to pay for it. This is not a financial issue. The money is in the grants. We can't find the experts. And it's not just health experts, it's financial experts, project management experts. So I think that's something that might interest you as committee members. And the second piece is, how do we augment the financing to the Global Fund? The needs are extraordinary. And one of the reasons that Vlasis has come with us is because we see a lot of opportunity in debt swaps. And your government has done debt swaps in the context of debt and climate. And we have many decades of experience doing swaps for health. So we'd really like to explore that as well. So let me leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the presentation and for the impressive numbers and work that you are doing. So I will pass the word. We have many parties here, and I will go through the representative power they have in our parliament. So I will give the word to the PSD. And the word will be, the deputy Francisco Sousa Vieira will use the word, and he is the coordinator of the party, PSD party, in the Health Care Commission. Please.
Thank you, Ms. President, dear colleagues, distinguished members of the Global Fund. Thank you very much for coming here today and to let us know the report that you presented here. I wrote some notes, and on behalf of the Partido Social Democrata parliamentary group, we thank you for coming today and for presenting this important Global Fund report. Your organization is also built upon two commitments that Portugal has also followed over time. The first one is the commitment to science and how science serves public health as well as the economy. And secondly, the commitment to solidarity between peoples, between countries, between more or less developed countries, starting with our strong relationship that we have with different countries, mainly different various African countries. And today we've had the opportunity to hear the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis and malaria. And this fund also aligns with our mission here at the House of Democracy. For instance, democratizing health is the first step toward democratizing everything else, education, housing, and so much more. What you have presented today in terms of scaling up your operational mechanisms is truly exciting and inspiring. And regarding AIDS, Portugal has made significant progress, but it is crucial that we do not ease our efforts. The impact of this disease extends far beyond the numbers of infections and deaths. It severely affects the quality of life, perpetuates social and economic inequalities, and fuels stigma. While we have seen a 56% reduction in new cases over the past decade, the stigma associated with HIV remains a major barrier. Over one third of people living with AIDS report facing social discrimination, highlighting the need to address both the disease and the prejudice surrounding it. As for tuberculosis, Portugal has the highest incidence rates in Western Europe, which is alarming and concerns us. These infectious diseases disproportionately affects the most vulnerable populations where access to healthcare is limited. Tuberculosis is treatable and curable, but achieving this requires continued strengthening of healthcare systems, including early detection and access to treatment. Although malaria was eradicated in Portugal in the 50s, it remains one of the leading causes of death in tropical regions. These three diseases are a stark reminder that global health is interconnected, and mitigating that their existence is not only about saving lives, but also about fostering social and economic development in the hardest hit regions. Eradicating these diseases must be a priority, as reducing their prevalence leads to healthier, more equitable and resilient societies. So, to finish this intervention, I would like to ask you a few questions. What are the main challenges that migration flows and demographic changes in certain countries may pose to the resilience of your strategy? And furthermore, despite having been mentioned here already, what are the key challenges in your relationship with governments that do not prioritize your mission? Thank you.
Thank you so much. I should say that our deputy is a physician, so he knows what he says and feels. Thank you so much for your words and for your information and for your always important participation in the Healthcare Commission. Thank you. And I will pass the word to our deputy, Paulo Pisco, from Partido Socialista, and then he will share the participation of Partido Socialista with the deputy José Luís Carneiro. Please.
Thank you so much, Chairman. It was really a pleasure to have you here and to listen about all your expertise in this domain. And in reality, I think it's very useful for us. Once we have our colleague that is from the Health Commission, but we are from the Foreign Affairs Commission, and we deal with the questions of cooperation for development, and mainly with the Lusophone countries that you mentioned here. My questions were about the insight that we have about what is happening in the Lusophone countries in these three main domains, which is the tuberculosis, malaria, and the HIV, and also I would like to ask you something that, because one of your objectives is to eradicate all these diseases. It's not easy in many cases, but we have reached in Cape Verde, which is something concerning malaria, which is something very important and is something that is very good also. We are very grateful for that because we had a very close relation with the Lusophone countries. And in the cooperation we have, of course, a cooperation in the domain of health. It's very important. But this is a kind of a hidden cooperation because Portugal is very generous in funding the fund, participating in the fund. And then it has a repercussion also in those countries with whom we have a very close cooperation. So it's very important to know and give us an insight, very important, about what we can do for improve what are the needs. And you mentioned here the need of expertise in those countries. So it's something that we can rely on and to have a discussion on that subject. Because in our committee, we speak about cooperation, but we don't go that in these specific domains, and they are really quite important. And so, I think it's need to have to deepening these kind of questions. So, this I would like you. Mainly, my questions are around the incidence of these three diseases that are happening in Lusophone countries. And also, what are the, in more general terms, your challenges concerning the pandemics? Because we have experienced the last one very broadly all over the world, which was the COVID-19. And in which terms are you preparing to new pandemics, and which kind of pandemics can we suffer in a, I don't know if near future, there are some experts that talk about near future or medium future, so this is something that is, I think is very interesting. And finally, I think you have a work which is a privileged work with the structures, governmental structures and local structures. Especially once again in the Lusophone countries, what can you tell us about this? And thank you so much for giving us this information, which is very useful for us, although we are not very familiarized with it. But thank you so much. I pass to my colleague, José Luis Carneiro.
Thank you very much. You here, as said my president, but I want to just put a question that is very simple. It's amazing the results of this financing and the overcome of this financing, this financement. And I want to ask how private sector can invest in your institution. And how we can mobilize, for example, local powers as a model of multi-level governance in the promoting of these goals, and how we can integrate the local powers, not just in financing, but as said my colleague, in the implementation of these objectives and these goals of your institution, because our president has a good relationship with local municipalities that are very strong in the development and promoting development goals in Portugal, and probably it's possible to involve our local municipalities in these objectives, not just in the conception, but also in the investment and in the overcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I will pass the word to the member of the Parliament from Chega, Rui Cristina.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Cumprimentar meus caras e caros colegas, deputados. On behalf of Chega Party, I would like to welcome you to the Assembly of the Portuguese Republic. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS since 2002 has mobilized efforts to combat some of the deadliest disease
that extremely affect the most vulnerable populations in the world. Over the past two decades, the Global Fund has helped to save millions of lives by financing treatments and distributing essential resources, strengthening the resilience of health systems in more than 150 countries. However, Portugal and the international community are facing new challenges, exacerbated by global mobility and financial pressures. Despite being the largest funder of programs against HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria, the Global Fund is also exposed to governance and transparency challenges. In 2011, fund diversions to the black market in African countries harmed the reputation and efficiency of projects. Today, this hearing is also important to understand how the Global Fund ensures the proper use of the resource, especially in regions with governance and vulnerabilities and corruption. Despite the challenge, the Global Fund has been a fundamental pillar in improving public health worldwide. The organization stands out not only for its capacity to mobilize resources, but also its innovation and adaptation to local needs. A notable example in the increased distribution of mosquito nets for malaria prevention and antiretroviral treatment for millions of people living with HIV, which has significantly reduced mortality rates. These advances were made possible through the Global Fund's public-private partnership model, which unites governments, civil society, and the private sector in a joint effort to maximize impact and ensure that one is left behind. I would like to make you some questions. In countries with high levels of corruption and political fragility, the Global Fund has faced significant challenge related to fund diversion, including to the black market. What specific measures have been implemented to prevent these situations, to ensure transparency in the use of resources, especially in sub-Saharan African countries? Taking into consideration the Global Fund's dependence on donations, what strategies are in place to promote the sustainability of local programs? How does the Global Fund to help beneficiary countries develop their own long-term financing capacities? And the growing threat of antimicrobial resistance is an additional challenge. How does the Global Fund incorporate antimicrobial resistance prevention into its programs to combat tuberculosis and other diseases? And what partnerships and funding are placed to address this silent pandemic? My last question, one of the goals of the Global Fund 2023 to 2028 strategy is to ensure equal access to diagnostics and treatments in all communities. What concrete measures are being taken to overcome access barriers in remote and high-risk communities, especially in African and Southeast Asia? Thank you.
Thank you so much. No one wants to use... Okay, a final question from myself. I think we have a new pandemic crisis. We have millions of refugees in camps with bad, terrible healthcare conditions. So we have a new pandemic situation, and I think your Global Fund will be important because some diseases that we thought never see again are re-emerging, and I would like to hear from you, because the two committees, the two commissions, want to know a little bit more and what can we do about public global health. That's one of our areas that join the two commissions. And I just want to highlight the importance of your fund, but everyone leaves, but you stay. Everyone runs, but you stay and you build capacity. It is very important, despite the problems that all those fragile countries have, political, no technicians. If you can give us more information about what you said in your presentation, that you have the resources, but sometimes you don't have people with the skills, and maybe we can be a way of passing information, because people trust us, and we can also share that information and pass it to our institutions. Thank you for your presentation and for your kindness.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that very rich discussion. It's wonderful, actually, to have the Health and the Development and Foreign Affairs Committees together, because, in fact, we see ourselves as contributing to both of those objectives. And as you said, pandemics don't understand borders, so we're all in it together in terms of global health. But also, the way in which development cooperation works is a political mechanism. So it's important to understand, you know, what are the benefits that you get from investing in a multilateral institution, and how does that help to build a more stable world, which I think we would all like to see. So let me try and address a few of these questions. So in terms of the main challenges we're facing, and many of you referred to this, there are a lot of populations on the move, right? Inside countries and between countries. So migration flows are really a huge challenge for health programs, because health programs by their nature try to be local. If your population moves away from where the clinic is that's providing the services, you have to move with them. So we have a number of ways that we try to address these, both in more sort of internal displacement because of climate change, and also because of conflict. So, of course, the examples vary, but I'll give you a few. One, we're working in Bangladesh on tuberculosis, and we've had incredible results in Bangladesh. They did really, really well. They have a quite strong health system, a very strong civil society in Bangladesh, and we were getting really good results. But increasing migratory flows from the coastal areas to the city, because of the flooding on the coastal areas and the salination of agricultural fields, so people can no longer farm their land because it's salty. So they move to the city, and there is a big increase in the population. 7 million people have moved around to the outskirts of Dhaka just in the last few years. So they're staying in their own country, but they're moving towards the city and living in very unsanitary informal settlements around the city. The rates of tuberculosis in that population are 7 times higher than the rates in the rest of the country. So you've had huge impact, but now you have a changing epidemiology, because TB is so infectious. As soon as you have people living in close quarters in unsanitary conditions, you get increases. You could say the same about refugee camps, right? So when people are crowded together in refugee camps, the rates of tuberculosis immediately increase. So one of the things we've been doing, in addition to trying to find all of the people who have TB, because obviously in order to bring down the incidence of TB, you need to find all those missing cases. They're infecting people all the time. So we've been scaling up new technology, which is small, portable x-rays, TB x-ray machines. They really are, I've seen them, they're in a backpack, you can carry it on your back. You can go into a refugee camp or into a very small informal settlement. You set the TB x-ray up on the sand, and you use digital technology to do AI-generated diagnostics with the TB. So it has its own digital recorder. If you're online, you can do it in real time. Otherwise, you download the data, you upload it when you can, and you do the diagnostics. So that's revolutionizing our ability to find those cases in migratory or moving populations. So I think adapting to how people are moving is really important. The whole emphasis on digitalization is really important as well, to be able to follow people where they are going. So making sure, we were just talking to my own health minister, the Minister of South Africa, Erin Motsoaledi, last week in New York at the UN General Assembly, and he was explaining how having the digital records now completely linked up with all of the clinics has meant that many of the migratory populations that they have of people crossing borders to get medicines in South Africa, at least now they can track them. They don't mind that people come for medication because they're trying to bring down the TB incidence in the whole of Southern Africa. But what they don't want is people coming in and getting medication 10 different times at 10 clinics and then taking it back. So the digital records is an important way of tracking and making sure that you have people. We had huge success in Ukraine, actually, with tracking people who obviously have been moving because of the conflict in Ukraine into neighboring countries, Germany, Poland, Macedonia, etc. And we managed to keep all of those people on treatment because we had digital records. The clinics in Ukraine were sending the information to Germany so that they could track the patients and continue their treatment, which is so important for things like AMR and multi-drug resistant TB. So those are some examples of how our programming is trying to adapt to follow people. You also mentioned the challenges around, and you also mentioned how do you work with governments, particularly around human rights. And if we look at the challenges in HIV, HIV is doing incredibly well. You mentioned some of the figures. HIV is the one disease that's on track to meet the targets in 2030. The challenge we have is around the barriers related to human rights barriers, so some of the discriminatory laws that have been introduced. So we already have discrimination even without laws, but in many of the countries in East Africa have started to introduce these LGBTQ discriminatory laws, which make access to services really, really difficult. And we have ongoing persistent gender inequities that mean that either gender-based violence or just gender discrimination means that young adolescent girls and young women are very vulnerable to HIV. So in the case of HIV, we invest specifically not in health programs, but in programs that actually either challenge discriminatory laws and ensure that people have access to services even when those laws are in place. So our programs in Uganda, for example, are uninterrupted. We just changed the way we worked. We made sure that those people could have access to services. And we do a lot around keeping girls in school. So that is a social intervention rather than a medical intervention. But it is the best way to keep girls safe is to keep them in education. So we pay them to stay in school so that their parents don't make them go out to work or they're not economically dependent on older men. You talked also about, we talked about the need to improve access to expertise for Lusophone countries. So I think the point around that is really to do the matchmaking. We talked to the government, both the Ministry of Health and Kamoesh today, about finding these experts who can speak Portuguese. We have the money. We know where the profiles are and what countries need the help. And it's a question of matching up the right people with the right needs. So we really would like to work on that together. We think it's a solvable problem. And by the way, that's not only medical expertise. In fact, it's mostly not medical expertise. We have medical experts in the countries. It's things like program management, financial management. You mentioned some of the challenges with corruption or with financial controls and management in country. Often it's an auditor that we're missing or somebody who understands how to do long-term planning for commodities and how to manage the commodities. So those are some of the skills that we would like to do. We talked a little bit about new pandemics and new challenges. Right now we are financing the response to the Mpox outbreak in DRC, Uganda, and some of the other countries in Central Africa. We're very flexible with our money, so if we see an outbreak, we immediately tell the countries they can use the money for contact tracing or something for the Mpox outbreak, so we're doing that. We're also looking at diagnostics, although with this particular outbreak, it's mostly the contact tracing you need to do because, unfortunately, the disease is very visible, so it can be quite easily diagnosed. But that's an example of where we're pretty flexible. We also work together with the WHO on the medical countermeasures network that we've established, where we're looking at what the next pandemic might be. And together with what we're seeing in terms of our surveillance that our countries are doing and what WHO is looking at, it's probably another viral respiratory infection, right? Something like monkeypox, and the Mpox outbreak is not going to be the next pandemic. You can see it. It's easily avoidable. It's quite hard to contract. It's like HIV. You really do need to have contact with somebody in order to be infected. Whereas viral respiratory infections, as we saw with COVID, are so much harder to detect. If you don't feel sick, and you don't even know you're sick, and you can infect other people. So that's probably why we're watching evolutions in the SARS virus at the moment, also keeping track of the COVID evolution in case it joins up with another virus, which is what people are worried about. So what we've been doing is reinforcing surveillance and the ability of laboratories to detect new variants and do gene sequencing. We've done a huge investment in Indonesia, for example, on gene sequencing capacity. It was the Global Fund's investments in Southern Africa, in Mozambique, in Botswana, in Eswatini, in South Africa, that detected the Omicron variant in December. You might remember I was stuck at home. They closed all the flats. So investing in that surveillance is really important for tracking new potential pandemics. In terms of the way the governments work and the structures, and I think this also addresses a little bit the issues around corruption that you were asking about in assurance. Firstly, one of the ways the Global Fund tries to address that is working in partnership. So we very rarely give the money only to the government. There is a multi-stakeholder partnership at the country level that decides how the money that will be spent and that watches that money. So we have a lot of engagement, and you were asking also about in the Lusophone countries, a lot of engagement with civil society. And in fact, GAT, the Portuguese platform on HIV here, as well as the civil society platform, work closely with civil society in the Lusophone countries to engage with the Global Fund. So there's a lot of capacity building that's happened over the years with that civil society. So participate in how Global Fund money is spent in those countries. And I think that's really important to understand how we work locally and why it's so important to have Portuguese-speaking experts as well so that they can interact with those local partners and build the capacity on the ground. But in addition to that local watchdog function, we have other levels of assurance now, and we did have a crisis in 2011. I would remind everybody that it was the Global Fund processes that alerted us to the fact that some of our money was going missing even then. The Global Fund has a policy of zero tolerance in terms of corruption and stealing our money. So we make sure that any money that goes missing gets paid back by the principal recipient, and we have 100% recovery rate. So, for example, if there is a corrupt practice in a country that we uncover, the principal recipient is responsible for that money. If they do not pay it back, we deduct that amount from the next allocation that country is going to get. So one way or another, we get that money back into the pot. And that zero tolerance policy has really helped with the accountability at the country level. We have formal structures. We have a local fund agent, which is an independent, usually private sector. You asked about the private sector as well. Private sector company that provides oversight, an accounting company that reports back to us on where the money is, and they do audits and spot checks in the country. We have an independent inspector general who reports directly to the board, not to the secretariat. And they do inspections, evaluations, audits across our portfolio. And we have a robust M&E that delivers these results. So these results are not made up. They are the way in which all of the dollars that have been spent by the Global Fund are reported. So I think we have a very robust assurance policy. But we're also investing more in public financial management, and that's also linked to the Portuguese-speaking expertise that we need, because we are trying to help the countries. We work in some of the poorest, most conflict-ridden countries in the world. They're not going to have the best accounting systems. So how can we go in, strengthen what public financial accountability they have, work with local national audit systems, for example, to properly audit the work at the national level to build sustainability in the way they track their own money. And then we also do, outside of that system, community-led monitoring. So we listen to the communities that are supposed to be served. Did you get the services, and so on? There's a lot we're doing on AMR. I can go into more detail, but just to say surveillance is one of the key things. We're also moving quickly to new products, so dual active ingredient bed nets that address the insecticide resistance, and also doing quality checks on drugs, because there's a lot of fake drugs out there, especially in the private sector, I'm afraid, that in countries like India, for example, tuberculosis treatment, fake drugs. We had fake drugs treating malaria in Asia. And so we did a special project that just got rid, working in a regional basis, got rid of all the fake malaria drugs on the market in Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand. So it's possible to do that if you really focus on it. And then I did talk a little bit about the camps and the portable x-rays. The other thing we do is provide flexible funding. So you talked about when we have crises or when there's humanitarian crises. We're very quick to adapt our funding in other ways if we need to. So adapt to mobile clinic provision, for example, or move the money from one region to another if you have a county that's affected by flooding. We also have an emergency fund that we can top up for crisis situations, refugee flows, or displaced people due to extreme weather events. So we use a lot of different tools to do that. And then on sustainability, one of the key things is that all of this is implemented locally. We are not a big development agency with staff in 100 countries. We don't work like that. We work with local actors from all sectors, including in the private sector. So the private sector sits on our multi-stakeholder group in the country and help to implement that. We're working, for example, in partnership in a number of countries to do health insurance schemes. Rwanda's a good example of that, where we're supporting a government mixed insurance policy where the government does the basic health insurance for primary health care and building up private sector insurance. South Africa is doing a similar scheme where we're trying to complement national health insurance plans with private sector insurance for people who are in the private markets and can afford to pay a certain amount towards their own health insurance so that those operate together and cover all of the needs of the country. Also, we're one of the organizations that receives the most amount of money from the private sector. So although it's only 5% of our income, because we have significant investments from governments, we get $1.2 billion from private commitments. So that's philanthropy, the private sector, private organizations. And in fact, we're about to announce two big new investments that are catalytic, because the private sector can invest catalytically in the Global Fund. One is focused on adolescent girls and young women and sexual and reproductive health and rights, entirely funded by private sector funding. And another is on climate and health, entirely funded by private sector funding. So the private sector can come in and push us to do things more quickly and more flexibly, and help to push the government programs towards areas where they're underinvesting. So that's how our public-private partnership works, and we think it's really very effective. So I think I answered all the questions. I hope that wasn't too overwhelming amount of information.
May I ask you, how many people work in the Global Fund, and how many of them are Portuguese? I don't know if you have the numbers.
I have the numbers. Overall, we're about 1,000 people, just over 1,000 people in Geneva. About half of those work on the country teams, but all in Geneva because we don't have country offices.
Okay.
And you might know the number of Portuguese staff.
And we have 14 Portuguese nationals.
Yeah.
1-4.
And many Lusophone staff.
Okay. What type of contracts do you have with them? Are they
our staff?
No, the contracts. What type of contracts do you have with your staff? Definitive contracts, temporary contracts.
It's a mixture.
A mixture.
Because
okay.
We have a core set of staff for core functions that have indefinite contracts, based on their position and the tasks that they do. Right now, I mean, I say we're just over 1,000. That's because mostly of the COVID investment we did. So we had $5 billion of additional funding for COVID. So we have a new workforce of about 200, 250 that are working on programming that $5 billion of COVID money. So probably we would shrink back down once that money is spent. We've got about another 18 months of implementation of the COVID money. And those were shorter term because obviously we didn't know if that money, I mean, we know that money's not going to come again, right? So that was a shorter term investment to get over the workload for COVID. Okay. Yeah.
It's quite challenging to work with so many different countries, and so they have quite different capacities, and you do a lot of capacity building and governance building and... okay, it's an yes. impressive work. Anyone wants to use the word?
No, I'm just saying I need to
okay.
Another meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
No one. Okay. We don't have questions. Thank you once again. I don't know if you want to take a photograph.
May.
And once again, okay, thank you so much. Thank you.